Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, the Hauenstein Center presents The Spy and the State. We get a preview of tonight's presentation. Professional counselor Jacob Moon joins in to talk about couples therapy. Resonant Strategies supports mission-driven nonprofits and leaders. We get the details. Paralympian Liz Baker joins in to talk about how being visually impaired does not stop her from competing in triathlons. And we discuss the premiere of Off Air May 30 at the Wealthy Theater.
Tonight is the night. Hauenstein Center presents Boetz for Presidential Study, The Spy and the State, the History of American Intelligence. It does feature Dr. Jeff Rogg, Senior Research Fellow at the University of South Florida's Global and National Security Institute. It's warming up here for you, Jeff. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Shelley?
I'm doing fine. Kayla Sweeney on behalf of the Hauenstein Center. Always a pleasure. Looking forward to this conversation and tonight.
Yep. Thanks, Shelley.
Yes. How will tonight roll?
Tonight is our standard, so we're going to have a 6 o'clock event here at the DeVos Center in Loosemore Auditorium. That's on Grand Valley City Campus, and folks can register online and find out more information. We have a whole, you know, lineup and information about our upcoming events, particularly for tonight.
Yes, and free and open to the public?
That is correct.
Video streaming available?
Yep, we have a virtual option as well.
But get yourself in the seat. That always allows for, I would think, even better conversation. Dr. Jeff Rogg, thank you for you, R-O-G-G. Don't forget the double G. You're doing great work in the great state of Florida. Tell us more about you.
Oh, sure. Well, it's funny because I grew up in Tampa, Florida, and then ended up back there for work. Originally, I worked at the Joint Special Operations University, which is part of Special Operations Command. Kind of busy these days, right? And then moved back into academia. Before that, I was very lucky as an academic because you don't always get to pick the places you lived, but I got to live in Charleston, South Carolina and work at the Citadel and in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island to work at the U.S. Naval War College. So it's been an interesting run, especially for someone from humble beginnings in Tampa, Florida.
Nice. Well, one gets paid off when they are doing good work. So congratulations on your success. Do we thank you for your service?
I was in the military, had an anticlimactic military career, and that's kind of what persuaded me to keep pursuing national security, but just different from what I intended to do in the Army.
Yes. Do you study the history of U.S. intelligence and its relationship with the American public?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that angle, because when you look at a lot of histories, you know, there's great spy stories. There's a lot of focus. What is the CIA doing as an organization? What are presidents doing? But you don't hear as much about the role of the American people in shaping intelligence history. And so one of the things I truly enjoyed about researching my book is like reading newspaper articles, listening to what people were saying at the time, seeing how their reactions were influencing the way policymakers were acting and congressmen were voting over intelligence.
Yes, my introduction did present the name, the title of your book, The Spy and the State. Is this the history of American intelligence?
That's the goal. It's appropriate that we're at the 250th birthday of the United States, because I like to begin in 1776, actually, with Nathan Hale. I took it all the way back there. One of the reasons why is, you know, when you work your way back rather than forward, you keep seeing these themes that repeat themselves. And I kept having to work backwards in the history because I kept seeing the same kinds of controversies and scandals and successes too happening. And I wanted to know why. And I wanted the average reader to understand American intelligence a little better.
Your book explores the origins and evolution of intelligence in America. Does it begin in 1776 or a little before?
It begins in 1776. And as I said, it begins with Nathan Hale. I think he's a great example of really what's complicated about American intelligence, because at the time, intelligence wasn't considered something honorable to do, and people tried to dissuade him from spying. And he says, according to legend, you know, he said a very famous line, "I regret that I have but one life to lose to my country, for my country." But he also said that anything that's necessary for public service is therefore honorable. So there's this tension in American intelligence history where we think intelligence is something that's un-American. It doesn't just quite rub us the right way. It's not what we believe in, but we know it's absolutely necessary for national security.
How would you explain the term intelligence to a fifth grader?
That's a great question.
Like me.
Oh, no, not at all. So there's different ways to think about intelligence. And often what you hear is intelligence is information for decision makers, or, you ask people and they'll think of James Bond. What I like to say is intelligence is a secret sphere of national security to understand and influence the world around you.
And again, back to your book, does it play an overlooked role in some of the key events that shape the nation?
Absolutely. And I would also add a lot of constitutional crises that we've had. You know, we are the oldest constitutional system. We have a written constitution. And when you look at things like domestic surveillance, when you look at covert action operations overseas that, you know, again, they seem to be un-American in principle throughout history. And that's why I bring in the news to it. These things make the news and they actually rattled the country in real ways. And they've resulted in, I'll talk about it tonight, how the FBI was created, how modern congressional intelligence oversight works or doesn't work. So you actually see really big decisions that affect the way we govern based on intelligence controversies.
Kaylor Sweeney, how will tonight work 6 o'clock on behalf of the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies?
Yep. So again, this is in downtown Grand Rapids on Grand Valley City Campus. We ask that folks check our website to register. That's gvsu.edu/HC. You can find information about the Hauenstein Center as well as this event there.
Great. And will there be an opportunity for question answer?
There is, yep. So the event will include remarks directly from Jeff as a mini keynote, as well as a moderated conversation with the Hauenstein Center's director, Megan Rydecki. And then we will hear questions from our audience.
What kind of questions do you get, Jeff? I'll stay with you.
So one thing that I'll encourage people who are listening and want to attend tonight is I am an intelligence historian in one respect, but I also, what I work on is contemporary national security and future national security problems. So a lot of questions I get aren't just about intelligence history, but you can imagine artificial intelligence and national security intelligence. What is the intelligence community doing today? What does the future look like for U.S. national security? So, you know, I say bring it all, past, present, and future of American intelligence.
Nice. And your books will be available for signing, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Tell me more about the concept of civil intelligence.
Oh, civil intelligence relations.
Well, you have a passion for this. You lit up like a
sunshine. Well, the reason why is something that's important in American history, and we do see it more often, is what you would call civil-military relations. You know, when you see generals and how they interact with presidents, there's a really well-established field of study, and it makes it into popular media of civil-military relations. We haven't seen anything similar really with intelligence. You know, how should intelligence officers relate to the government that they work in and then the society that they serve? So that's simply what civil intelligence relations is. Intelligence is its distinct profession of national security, and how does it fit with the government and the society that it serves?
Are you, did you say you're academia, are you teaching?
So I adjunct right now. I've taught before, and I'm kind of looking forward to getting back into teaching again soon.
Yes, and what would be your ideal student?
Great question. You know, I had a professor who spent, and he was influential in the book, and he spent the better part of his career in the CIA. From the earliest Cold War, I interviewed him, and he was in the third CIA recruitment class in the 1950s all the way through the end of the Cold War. And he said something that always resonated, which is, when he looked for good recruits, you can't fake curiosity about the world. Curiosity about the world, that's the starting point.
Nice. And are you ready? Or have you been celebrating A250?
100%. One thing that I want people to walk away from understanding is I'm a big fan of boxing, and there's a great boxing referee named Joe Cortez, and he used to say to fighters before the fight, I'm firm, but I'm fair. That's how I approach American intelligence history. You know, I call balls and strikes. I say what we did well, what we didn't do well. But what I want people to understand is, you know, we're a better country for it, and there's a lot to be proud of, both in American intelligence and for the country at 250.
Your book is The Spy and the State, The History of American Intelligence, available tonight as we attend the 6 p.m. Opportunity through Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies. How do we find out more about you, Dr. Jeff Rogg?
Sure, absolutely. I have a public profile on LinkedIn with my name, and then sometimes I'm on social media these days, although I'm going to talk about that tonight at handle at The Spy and the State on X. And the spy, the state, so no and actually. And like I said, I'll might warn people away from social media, even though I myself am guilty of using it.
You know, some of us still post what we had for lunch, so don't take it away just yet. Kaylor, your final word, please.
We just are really excited to have Jeff here in Grand Rapids. The Hauenstein Center's mission to raise a community of ethical and effective leaders for the 21st century. And we think this is the type of programming that gets our community and our students, faculty and staff here at GV and in Grand Rapids thinking about these really big leadership issues facing our country.
Great. Enjoy your time here in West Michigan. And thank you for both of you, Dr. Jeff Rogg and you, Kayler Sweeney. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Marriage and family therapist, professional counselor, seeing couples, and more, Jacob Moon in the house. Let's talk, generally about the topic and maybe zone in on EMDR. I'll see if you can solve all my problems in these next 10 minutes, Jacob Moon. They're few, but we all have something, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, how do I get all three dogs to behave? How's that?
Yeah, no, that's behavior therapy. I don't deal with that.
Jacob Moon, I am glad you're here. You do have a passion to get the word out, but obviously you have a passion to talk relations. Even your website, RelateGR.com, moves us to that. What's your elevator pitch? How do you spend your day?
Oh, these days, I would say mostly seeing couples. I mean, we are a practice that is trauma-informed, and so we do see clients through like individual family in addition to couple. So we do a lot of trauma work, EMDR work, but primarily we are practice set up focusing on couples. And so, today was really more wanting to talk a little bit about like some of those myths, right, that keep people away from getting help.
Yes. What more still on the pitch? Who's we? Do you have you with
the
clinic?
Yeah. So my colleague Aaron Cullum is one of my colleagues in the office downtown here, and then I have an intern and a limited license that I supervise and oversee.
Yes. And why did you enter this profession?
Oh man, that's a complicated question. But I think in the short, it's more focused on. I wanted to understand why relationships don't work.
Yes. What's a myth you'd like to dispel?
I think one of the bigger myths is the if we're coming to couples therapy, it means that the relationship is like in really big trouble and it's, you know, close to ending. So I think, you know, this idea I think essentially keeps us away from then couple therapy because we're going, okay, if I go, it's reality, it's over, right? Whereas we're starting to find couple therapy is something that can be really preventative. It can come early in a relationship. It can come in really bad stages in a relationship. But really, it is something that is really just helping couples create a shared language together.
Do you ask that the couples be married?
No.
So that could be another myth as well.
Yeah.
I need to be married as a couple. Do you ask that there's individual therapy in addition to a couple?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it just depends on, you know, whether or not one or both partners have the sort of emotional capacity to be able to sit with each other and move through the conflicts that they're dealing with. So if they have some emotional language, we can usually work with that. But I do encourage doing individual concurrently to be able to sort of also process what they're experiencing days after they have couple therapy.
Do you have homework?
For me, if I give homework, it's really, I want it to flow naturally. So if it's something where I go, okay, this feels natural to give, then I'll give it. But I tend not to like give structured homework that you might see with like a Gottman method therapist.
What's another myth perhaps that we need to make sure that go back to the word dispel?
Yeah, I think one of the big ones is that we're going to take sides. Yeah.
Okay, so and you say we're meaning you?
Yeah, the couple therapist. Yeah, the person seeing the couple is that we are going to start leaning heavily on one or the other side. Yeah. Yeah, this is a big one because you know, they're already in a rough place in their relationship when they're coming in. Oftentimes, I mean, typically on average, it takes about 6 years for a couple to come to couple therapy, you know, 6 years after the problem starts. And so when they're in that place, right, we're very skeptical and we might be a little bit more like have a little bit more paranoia about like, how does this process work when I'm already dealing with something that's so heavy? And so that can be one part of it, is that we are going to take one side over the other, But I tend to work from a model called emotion focus therapy. And so this really focuses in on the cycle that the couple's going through, what their patterns look like. And so it really doesn't focus on you're right, you're wrong. It focuses on like, what is the pattern that's happening that is getting you into this place.
And I imagine another myth is everyone is going to, you know, once a week for 6 weeks. I imagine therapy differs regarding what this couple needs and that couple needs.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think typically in the beginning of treatment, to be able to establish really good rapport and have a good relationship with a couple therapists, because it can be such a sensitive thing that they're going to do, we really do want to do weekly until we get to a spot where we both built rapport and then help the couple really identify their cycle. But we want to meet couples where they're at, right? So if they have kids or they both have jobs and they're going long hours, I will still take a couple and see them biweekly.
Is it important that you stay as their therapist?
Meaning what?
Meaning that you are with that couple for the duration.
Oh, yeah.
Unless, obviously, you have to fly to, you know,
sure,
Aruba for vacation.
Yeah. I mean, that's ideal, right? Like, we want to be able to begin treatment with a couple and be the one to see that through. And also, we recognize, just like individual therapy or family therapy, that fit is really essential in making treatment move the way in which they want it to move, or at least move more successfully. So ideally, yeah, we would want to stay through that process. And in EFT or emotion focused therapy, you know, treatment's about 1 to 2 years. Yeah.
Marriage and family therapist, professional counselor Jacob Moon in the house. You mentioned EMDR. You use EMDR treatment for trauma?
Mm-hmm.
How's it work?
Yeah. So We use it for trauma, and traditionally it had originally been built on individual work for PTSD, and now it's branching out to complex PTSD, depression, anxiety. We're seeing some benefit in OCD, but I utilize EMDR in couple sessions when it comes to affair recovery. You know, there's an affair in the relationship, the symptoms that the partner experiences that, you know, related to their partner's affair actually mimics PTSD symptoms. And so I utilize EMDR in the treatment of being able to help them decrease the symptoms of what they're experiencing, so that we can actually get into the meat of why they found themselves so disconnected.
What falls under your treatment of sexual trauma?
Depends on the individual or couple, but you know, I think for individuals, you know, I utilize EMDR for sexual trauma, and so it's a whole process for EMDR, right? I have to go through treatment planning and whatever kind of goes with that. So it is getting that history taking completed and being able to move through EMDR to treat that sexual trauma. When it comes to couples, a little bit different, right? So if a couple is really locked up in their cycle, their pattern, you know, related to those difficulties, the sexual trauma treating that is something that might end up coming later in couple therapy, when we can get them to see their cycle and then choose to move through an argument differently or a conflict differently. When they can start to do that, then we can actually start to unpack those things.
How do you know you've had a good day?
Oh, man. Oh, yeah. It's tough, right? Because, like, I have a great day every day. But there are the times I think I will come out of a couple session at the end of the day. And I think in that moment, like, I think today I'm my favorite therapist. Mm. Yeah.
How does one get in touch with you and if and when needed, Jacob?
Yeah. So you can go to relategr.com. And then you can also look us up on Instagram. It's at Relational Collective.
All right. Anything else you'd like to share?
Love each other.
Yes. Start yesterday. All right. Keep us together or work us through, as they say. Marriage and family therapist, professional counselor, both the couples you see and more. Thanks for the time, Jacob.
Thank you.
Next guest comes to your rescue. She supports mission-driven nonprofits and leaders navigating growth, transition, or moments, well, where the current way of working no longer fits. And that can happen, I imagine. Joanne Rome, you would agree. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Shelley.
We've touched base many a time. Remember your days at Gilda's?
I do remember my days at Gilda's, yes.
And then Barris and more, and I'm so proud that now you are kind of a doing your thing with your expertise. Congratulations.
I am. Thank you so much.
Tell me about Resonant Strategies and how it came to be.
Sure. So I've spent my career in nonprofit and higher education, worked with a variety of organizations, leaders, teams, and seen and been exposed to a lot of challenges that the nonprofit sector faces, and also a lot of challenges that female leaders specifically experience. My doctoral work in organizational change leadership centered on leaders who were mothers during the pandemic. And all of this kind of came together at this point in my career that I wanted to be able to support those who, in a lot of ways, have had similar journeys as I am as a mother and a leader, but support the organizations in this community that I care so deeply about when they are, as you mentioned, experiencing change, need to build infrastructure, or need to build capacity. And thus, Resonant Strategies, my consulting firm, was born.
Yes, and yes, I do need to reintroduce you as Dr. Joanne Rome. You worked hard for that. I remember that that journey. Kudos to you. So the practical piece, you consult for one who needs some clarification on their identity and direction during times of change. Let's talk more.
Yeah, so I work with organizations, as I mentioned, in infrastructure building, capacity building, times of change, and in fund development strategy. But I also work with individuals. So I do one-on-one coaching for women who are leaders in their organizations. And I also have a couple of cohort-based programs that I have launched that anybody, it's open for applications right now, both programs. The first is in its second cohort. It's called the Next Gen Resonance Circle. And that is for rising leaders in our community who are navigating their careers and also their personal lives simultaneously, that act of balance that doesn't really exist. I talk a lot about integration. How do we integrate all those different areas of our lives and be successful and happy? And then Resonant Mothers is the other program launching at the beginning of May. That's in partnership with friend of both of ours, Brendan Kelly at The Well-Being. The Well-Being is an innovative center that combines mental health and physical health all in one space. And so the Resonant Mother is a six-week program for mother leaders that combines physical fitness and group that meets at the same time, workout then the group. And really, again, all of this is driven from my dissertation, where I recognize that two things that were central to the mothers that I interviewed in my study were physical fitness and community, and having that community that they can lean on as they're navigating these times in their lives.
And yet, obviously, their career important.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for women, there's a lot of different parts of our lives that we balance simultaneously and are expected, or we expect to be exemplary in. So leadership in our organizations, climbing the career ladder, being a super mom, being a fantastic partner and friend, and on and on and on. And so often we compartmentalize those things. One thing takes precedence over something else. And so we really talk about integration and whole person leadership. How do we bring our whole selves to all the things that we do?
What's the answer to that question?
You'll find out if you come and be a part of these programs. But a big answer is community. I mean, that really is a part of it. Shared experience and being in community with people who are navigating similar experiences as you are. It's a reflective program. Both of them are. Lots of journaling and prompts involved. It's not about learning how to be a better leader. It's about learning more about yourself.
Let me stay with the moms and then half a step back to Next Gen, maybe the same answer for both. Are these in person?
So the Next Gen program is a virtual program, so folks can join from anywhere in the country, and we've had folks from all over the state of Michigan be involved so far in the first cohort. The Resident Mothers is an in-person program because we do have that physical activity part of the program that happens at the beginning of each session.
Which I think is fairly unique.
It
and,
is.
And needed.
Yes, and there's definitely some gaps, I think, around how we tie ourselves together, right? How we integrate all these different facets of our lives in order to be successful and happy. And yeah, to combine physical fitness, and this is what our friends at The Wellbeing do so well, physical fitness with mental and emotional well-being and support and community is definitely something I feel that is unique to this program.
And obviously you're setting that client up for a lifestyle.
Absolutely. And that's the goal, is to help them be more in tune with themselves, their wants and their needs, and to be able to move through life in a more whole and integrated way.
Next Gen mom and more when it comes to the topic of resonant strategies. Dr. Joanne Rome with us, leadership coach, strategist, facilitator, educator, mom, and more. So the next Gen resonant circle starts when?
Starts the last week in April. It's on Mondays and during the lunch hour, April 27th. And then Resonant Mothers starts the following week on Thursday evenings, the first week in May.
And how are you working with individuals on a one-on-one basis?
Yeah, so I do one-on-one coaching. I'm not a therapist. I like to say that. It's professional coaching, but coming from a place of whole life, whole person leadership. So we do talk about the other facets of life in addition to career. But oftentimes I coach, again, early leaders, those who are just stepping into leadership roles in an organization, managing increased workload, managing gender disparity, managing home lives, and trying to figure out how to do all of that and not burn out.
And are you working with organizations in general coming in and perhaps presenting to a nonprofit, for-profit, and more?
Yeah, so I work with nonprofit clients both in Grand Rapids and in Kalamazoo. I'm working with three wonderful organizations right now, all very different organizations. One is more focused in fund development strategy, as you know, Shelley. That's a big part of my background, how I came up. So working with them on developing some fundraising strategy. I'm doing some capacity building and infrastructure building for an organization who just appointed a new executive director but has been in a place of transition there. And then I'm working with another organization that is, I'm going to say, in the midst of reinventing themselves right now. And I get to work with them and stakeholders in the community to help ensure a new direction. So all really fun work, and such a privilege to work with so many great organizations in our community and in Kalamazoo as well.
Wow. Be careful what you wish for, Joanne Rome, on your adventure as you sail into your next space, as they say. All right, Resonant Strategies. How do I get signed up?
Yeah, resonancestrategiesconsulting.com. You can find me on LinkedIn as Joanne Rome as well, or you can email me at joanne@resonancestrategiesconsulting.com.
All right, wonderful. Thanks. Call you a friend, but yet you are Dr. Joanne Rome with your resonant strategies. Kudos to you.
Thanks, Shelley.
Did you know 7 million people in the U.S. have vision impairment? We just came off Save Your Vision Month. Every month should be a Save Your Vision Month, reminding us to check in on our eye health and ensure our vision is in top shape. No news to my next guest. Liz Baker, diagnosed with Stargardt's disease in her teens, experienced a central vision loss while retaining peripheral vision. But here's the silver lining. She is a Paralympian living with Stargardt's disease. So I get to talk to you. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. All right. What are your sports?
Triathlon.
Oh, that's what I do. I should have done my research. There we are. There we are. Liz, tell me your adventures with I Trust Tokyo and beyond.
Yes. So I actually competed in the 2016 Rio Paralympic Games, and it was the debut of triathlon for the Paralympics that year. And then I continued to compete and retired after Tokyo in 2021.
What's your strength, swim, bike, or run?
Oh, I like them all.
That's a good answer. All right, I'll ask the blunt question. How do you do this with Stargardt's disease?
Well, it's pretty amazing. I have a guide the entire race, and it has to be the same sex, so female, and she has to be better than me on her worst day. Wow. So she swims tethered to me. However, she can't go ahead of my head. Like my head, I have to be the one leading, or we'd be disqualified. So we tether around our calf, and then she uses different things like bumping me certain directions so that I know where I'm supposed to go. So I'm never sighting a buoy. She is. I'm just swimming. And then we get out, and she guides me through the transition. Excuse me. And we get onto a tandem bike. And so she obviously is in the front of the tandem bike. And then we move through to the run, and we're tethered around our waist for that. And again, she is my eyes through the entire thing. So I'm asking, what's my pace? Where's my competition in front and behind? And she grabs the water when we pass a water station. So she's an incredible person for me.
Thank you. And of course, now rightly so, retired from your great work and now, speaking about your great work, Liz, what is Stargardt's disease?
Stargardt's disease is sort of like a children's form of macular degeneration. It has a different pathophysiology for how it occurs. However, the way it manifests is very similarly with the loss of your central vision, or what I like to kind of call your detailed vision. Anything that you need to read or details in people's faces, those types of things, you lose that ability.
So a blunt question, what can you see now looking straight ahead?
That's funny. I get that a lot. Yeah. If I were, say, looking at your face and you were standing maybe a foot in front of me, I might be able to make out like one of your eyes. However, the other eye would sort of be not there. Part of your nose wouldn't be there. I wouldn't really be able to tell if you had glasses or earrings. With men, I can't tell if they have facial hair.
Yes. And yet you are living your life. And maybe I'm going to get into the details a little bit. You're a mom and much more. You use eSight, which is a wearable device company that's based here in Grand Rapids.
It is. It is. And I was thankful to have met the eSight Go probably about a year to a year and a half ago. And it's changed my life.
All right. What is it?
It is a wearable, and it really helps. I mean, it could help anybody, so there's no reason to not attempt to use it, but it's specifically great for people with that central vision loss. I don't exactly know how it works. However, when I look through eSight Go, I'm able to see clearly in real time all of those things that I can't typically see. So if I want to read a piece of mail, I can read a piece of mail. I can read what a measuring cup is and what, you know, if it's 1/4 or 1/2, I can see my family's faces. I actually started using it to be able to see the pressure gauge of the blood pressure when I was because I'm a physical therapist. So I initially started using it for that purpose because I needed to take my patients' blood pressures. But it's just led into so many different things that I use it for now.
Is it available for the layman?
It is available, and they can go on the eSite website, or they can go to a doctor and get a referral and then take the referral to eSite, or they can actually buy directly from a resale seller that sells them.
Oh, yes. What is that website? You have it handy?
Let me see. It is eSite Eyewear. So eSite is just eSiteEyeWear.com.
It's as easy as that. Liz Baker, she's a Paralympian, diagnosed with Stargardt's disease in her teens, and of course, continuing to lead an extraordinary life as a mother, PT, athlete, of course, competing in the Paralympics as a triathlete. Not only are well, I'm not quite the triathlete you are, but I also practice physical therapy in my first career. So we've got things
nice.
To talk about, Liz. Oh, my goodness.
One of my sisters.
Yes, yes. And I had a wonderful detached retina last year. So I'm still working on life, too. But I guess the closing comment, Liz, how does one continue to seek life to its fullest with challenges?
Well, I like to say that I think everybody is going to face a challenge at some point. This just happens to be mine. Mm. And I think that the way that we handle those challenges, whether we let them control us or we control how we will move forward with them, is the biggest determinant. And I have just chosen to not let this define me. Instead, it is just a part of me, and I use it to my advantage every day.
It's like talking to us and still being active. eSite is a wearable device company. It's based right here in Grand Rapids, so I expect you to stop in next time you are here. Liz Baker, is there another triathlon in your life?
Maybe just for fun.
Hope
not
so.
At the level I was doing it.
Well, Grand Rapids has plenty, so come join us. One more time, what's our best website on eSite and you?
Sorry, excuse me.
Yes, what's the best way to find out more about eSite and you?
So I think for eSite, go to that webpage that I mentioned. And for myself, I am under Elizabeth Wilson Baker on Facebook. So most of my travel endeavors were recorded there because they were a bit ago and not so much on Instagram.
Keep on doing you and inspiring others. Liz Baker, again, Paralympian, and sharing her work with us, reminding you 7 million of us do have vision impairment. So stay the course. Thanks, Liz.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Great to meet you.
Mark your calendar for May 30th. Yep, time to talk May. April showers will bring those May flowers. So let's put the calendar to attend Wealthy Theater's event, 7 p.m., and that would be my next guest event. Good that you are here to talk about your labor of love. Abby Lemke, hey, what happened in a COVID pandemic is now coming to fruition. I introduce you as a Grand Rapidian, stand-up comedian, filmmaker, and more. Good morning, Abby.
Good morning.
Appreciate you. And, of course, what we see off the air come May 30th. Of course, that caught my ear because we are on air. Huh? So I have a feeling it has something to do with this realm. Abby, tell us a little bit about you, please.
Yeah. So like you said, I started my writing and comedy with stand-up comedy, actually, and writing my own jokes. I've been doing stand-up comedy for over 6 years now, and I run my own show at the Garage Bar. It's an open mic, and I love my favorite part about stand-up comedy is just writing the jokes. And so during COVID, there wasn't as many open mics. So me and one of my stand-up comedian friends wrote a script together. I had an idea because I personally had spent time working on radio, like on a radio station, and my father also worked in radio growing up. So I was very familiar with that idea and concept. So I thought it was a really good starting point for writing a comedy and like a little sitcom. So yeah, it's a TV show. What will be premiering on May 30th is the pilot episode. So we wrote and filmed the pilot episode, and my hope would be that, you know, it'd get picked up or something, and then we would continue to write it and film it here in Grand Rapids.
Wonderful. Yep, got a dream, but yet you have to start with a pilot, so keep the faith. What's the show about?
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's about a local community radio station that tragically loses their star radio show host. And the station manager scrambles to recruit a grocery store employee to co-host his local radio show. And she navigates her first big day on the job alongside her pushy co-host. And that's kind of what happens in the first episode. And there's a little bit of a teaser to make you want to, like a kind of like a cliffhanger at the end to make you want to watch more. So unfortunately, there is a cliffhanger.
Yes, which there probably should be. I trust in the world of screenwriting. You want it's kind of like when way back when I kind of watched soap operas. You just couldn't wait till the next day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little. You cast local talent here.
Yeah, I did. So I used social media out and websites, and I posted and kind of word of mouth spread. I had about 50 people audition locally and about 20 people come to callbacks. And we picked people. We had over 100 volunteers on the project. It is the lowest budget film I've ever seen. So, yeah, it's really cool seeing the community come together to make this thing happen. It's awesome. I just love the power of working together.
And talk a little bit about, your filmmaking process. Obviously, this is professional, and what we see, how many minutes do we see on screen?
Yeah, so it's still in the editing process. It's currently at 26 minutes, but it'll probably land around 24 minutes long. Like, the process of it is just kind of connecting with local resources. So GRCMC, Grand Rapids Community Media Center, shout out. We were able to, through the membership there, rent cameras and use their resources to be able to film a lot of the stuff. We had all the sound equipment we could rent from them. It was just, it's such a great local resource.
Chris and his team, of course, Starla and the whole good group with that realm, talking with Abby Lemke, local Grand Rapids stand-up comedian, filmmaker, and of course, off air May 30th, 7 p.m. Wealthy Theater. How does one get tickets?
Yeah, so you can go online to GRCMC or the Wealthy Theater events, and you can search off air, or you can go to events on May 30th. It's on the Wealthy Theater website, and I would definitely recommend get your tickets sooner than later, because you never know, if we sell out, then you might not get the opportunity.
Yes, yes, you bet. And then do we find your personal work, say, on YouTube and more?
Yeah, definitely. I would just recommend just going to Garage Bar Comedy Night on Tuesdays. I'm always there. So
that's Garage Bar downtown on Ottawa, correct?
Exactly. Yep, 819 Ottawa.
Cool place. Okay, May 30th, the place to be. It'll be here before we know it, 7 p.m., Wealthy Theater, off air. We're on air here, but it's good to be off air as well in your world. Abby, thanks for your time. Have fun.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Oprah Winfrey says, be thankful for what you have. You'll end up having more. If you concentrate on what you don't have, you will never, ever have enough. So there is your inspiration for the day. Hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Shelley Irwin.